From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week at the Democratic National Convention, not when the primetime speakers were on stage, but early in the night on Monday. It was really late Monday afternoon, a time when a lot of slots were given to party officials who were not high wattage, maybe not great speakers, or not considered part of the group of future national leaders. One of those speakers was the governor of New York State, Kathy Hochul. She came on stage to light applause, and during her roughly 5 minutes, the convention hall seemed half distracted, focused on other things. To my eye, it was rather remarkable. Last week, we saw the governors of Michigan and Maryland and Pennsylvania and New Mexico and Illinois and North Carolina giving primetime addresses and becoming household names. And yet the governor of New York State, one of the most populous and consistent blue states, was relegated to Monday afternoon when barely anyone would hear her. But those were just the optics. To people like Michael Kink or Olivia Lehrer, there was another point of difference, much more important. What they see is Kathy Hochul is a very different kind of Democrat than Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. Democrats emerge from their convention proclaiming unity and common cause. But Kink and Lehrer don't exactly buy it. They see a divide between those who truly favor workers and those who are propped up by a wealthy and corporate class. In the New York Daily News, Kink and Lehrer teamed up. Kink is with a coalition, the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Olivia Lehrer is a co-director of New York Communities for Change. And this is part of what they wrote in an op-ed, quote, "Though it's still early days in the Harris-Walz campaign, it's clear that they're embracing an agenda of structural economic reform that rebuilds dignity for the working class, addresses corporate power over our everyday lives, and confronts climate destruction head-on. Kathy Hochul has instead championed the failed politics of corporate Democrats that have screwed over millions of working people," end quote. I wanted to explore the differences and understand the substance beyond the rhetoric, especially as we're coming off of a convention week when a lot of people were plugged into this. My guests this hour include Olivia Lehrer, co-director of New York Communities for Change. Olivia, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Kink is back with us, executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having us.
I want to listen first to two different sound clips from last week. And I'm going to start with Kamala Harris, the vice president, in her convention speech on Thursday night. I want to listen a little of the section that she had on the economy and how she sees the role of the federal government in the economy.
And we are charting a new way forward. Forward to a future with a strong and growing middle class, because we know a strong middle class has always been critical to America's success. And building that middle class will be a defining goal of my presidency. And I'll tell you, this is personal for me. The middle class is where I come from. My mother kept a strict budget. We lived within our means, yet we wanted for little. And she expected us to make the most of the opportunities that were available to us and to be grateful for them. Because, as she taught us, opportunity is not available to everyone. That's why we will create what I call an opportunity economy, where everyone has the chance to compete and a chance to succeed. Whether you live in a rural area, small town, or big city. And as president, I will bring together labor and workers and small business owners and entrepreneurs and American companies to create jobs, to grow our economy, and to lower the cost of everyday needs like health care and housing and groceries. We will provide access to capital for small business owners and entrepreneurs and founders.
That's part of Vice President Harris's speech from Thursday night at the convention. And now I want to listen to a bit from New York Governor Kathy Hochul, who had did not have a primetime speaking slot. You might have missed some of her remarks, but here is from Governor Hochul.
Like so many of us, My grandparents came from Ireland as teenagers with nothing but hope in their hearts and fire in their bellies. They built their lives in the promised land of Buffalo, New York. A union card meant good work at the steel plant. The steel plant that lifted my parents from living in a trailer to the middle class. Like other families in my blue-collar community, they believed that with hard work, they could build a better future, not just for themselves, but for those with less hope and less opportunity. I'm proud of my roots and the values I learned. Grit, determination, compassion. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz grew up with those same values. And those values have always defined the people of my state. Well, most of us anyway. Donald Trump was born a New Yorker, but ended up a fraud, a philanderer, and a felon.
That's Governor Kathy Hochul. And so, Michael, I'll start with you. I mean, am I being, first of all, uncharitable to point out how strange it was to see the governor of New York State kind of relegated to a non-primetime slot when there was so much going on that got America's attention last week? She didn't seem to be one of them.
I think that's real. And, you know, particularly when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got a primetime speaking slot and brought down the House, you know, someone that was perceived a few years ago as some sort of a leftist speaking to the broad mainstream of the Democratic Party about worker power, about affordability, and about reducing the extreme inequality that is both causing and the result of the kind of economy we have right now. You know, the governor and the vice president both had admirable immigrant narratives. Both of them were very real about their families. But you heard the vice president talk about serious substantive policy goals, affordable health care, housing, and groceries, about building a middle class, and about taking on corporate power and greed. Those are the kinds of things that Governor Hochul and other, you know, kind of corporate Democrats in New York sometimes shy away from. And I think the point here, as the vice president said in her speech, there's a new way forward. This is kind of, you know, change versus more of the same. And Democrats in many parts of the country are united on the kind of change that will bring real benefits to working people that you can feel. And more of the same is like half a loaf, quarter of a loaf, tenth of a loaf, you know, 25th of a loaf. Those are the call up kind of policies that we see too often from Kathy Hochul.
Olivia, let me ask you kind of the same question. I mean, I wonder if the governor's office would argue, now, this is not fair. The governor was talking about very similar issues about, you know, about that immigrant story, about the, you know, the problems of inequality, about making a more fair and just society, wasn't she? What did you hear?
I think I would point to the governor's track record, and especially when you compare it to Governor Walz's track record, where he's feeding kids free lunches, where he's taking real concrete steps to make economic policy in his state really for the people and progressive, whereas, you know, Kathy Hochul has been giving away, you know, big boondoggles to the Buffalo Bills, pumping lots of money into corporate subsidies and, you know, making sure that her budget, we're fighting tooth and nail year over year of her administration to not see cuts, to not see regressive rollbacks to policies like bail reform, to, you know, eke out a housing deal that's going to make New Yorkers not see giant increases in their rent. And so I think when the rubber meets the road, it's pretty clear that they're not aligned on an economic agenda.
Well, we're going to explore more of what that means. But part of, I think, what might trip us up is this never ending debate about, you know, was that a centrist convention or was that a left? Yeah. And I want to talk about some of those definitions and why they matter. But part of that also comes into how people govern. So I'm thinking of two very different ideas, two different things here. In 2010, the Affordable Care Act passes. And my observation at the time, and I'm nobody. People shouldn't take my word for it. But what I was seeing was a lot of congressional Democrats almost scared to run on it. They were apologetic for it. They're getting hammered at town halls by Republicans, and people didn't like it, or maybe, you know, have been watching conservative media and thought it was a socialist takeover of the country. And Democrats kind of ran away from it and, didn't do very well in the midterms in 2010. Contrast that with what Tim Walz told the New York Times about a month ago. What he told the New York Times is he has a different theory of governing. He says that too often in American politics, there's an idea that you have to build up capital with your voters and you got to spend it very carefully. And so when people get elected, maybe they ran on something, but, you know, if we pass this tax cut or tax increase, if we pass this policy, if we pass this plan, then maybe it'll upset people. And yeah, we ran on it, but if we pass it, we can't get reelected. So let's do sort of a weak tea version, or maybe not do it yet. And let's be careful and let's get reelected. And Walz told the New York Times he views it very differently. He said that the reason you get political capital is to spend it. And that if you can accomplish what you ran on, well, that's why you ran in the first place. And that you should be proud to run for reelection on actually doing the thing that you said that you were going to do. And you can trust people to believe that it's a popular thing, even if it's going to be characterized as an extreme thing. So, Walz, for all the talk about, you know, sort of his centrism, he's centrist in temperament, but his governing record is to spend political capital and to let the voters decide. Whereas I think a lot of, you know, people who get into office think, I can't vote for that. You know, like I got to run on election. And there are two different notions there. Michael, what do you make of what Governor Walz is saying versus, you know, maybe the Affordable Care Act days in 2010 or just this idea that you've got to be very careful on how to spend political capital?
I love it. I love the conversation. I love the quote. You're not nobody. Like, you captured the essence of this fight right there. The ACA now is among the most popular programs. When Olivia and I were in Washington in 2018 fighting and doing civil disobedience with people with disabilities and moms with kids that needed health care, right, we both kept and protected the ACA, and Democrats did great in that midterm because we demonstrated this is a serious, meaningful thing for regular people and they can benefit from it. And I think Governor Walz has exactly the right idea. Get what you can get done. Go big so that people can really feel it. And then run for re-election on real results. You know, he had a one-seat majority in the Minnesota legislature. And they did free childcare for young families, expanded funding for public schools, tuition-free college, family and medical leave. You know, real significant middle class, working class tax cuts, and then a capital gains on the wealthy to pay for it. They pushed through a package that people could see and feel. And they asked the richest Minnesotans and the wealthiest corporations to pay what they owe. And it turned out to be really popular and successful. And I think what we're seeing here overall is a new model for successful politics. You know, Kathy Hochul is trying to be the, like, you know, 34th Xerox copy of Bill Clinton compromising and triangulating. And there's a new way forward that is real. We saw it in the Democratic convention. We've seen it with Governor Walz, Governor Whitmer. Democratic governors with sometimes tighter margins than Hochul has had in the legislature fighting to win. And there are other Democrats all across New York, some that are sometimes perceived as, you know, working class lunch pail Democrats, that support these types of programs, that support unions and more people being able to get into unions, less corporate welfare. But, you know, fighting to a new common sense where we understand that that is really popular and that is really, quote unquote, you know, mainstream. I don't know if moderate or conservative or liberal or progressive effectively labels it, when what we see in New York is significant majorities of all voters, including Republicans and conservatives, saying we should have higher taxes on the rich and lower taxes on working people. We should have a significantly higher minimum wage. It should be easier to organize and become a member of a union. Those are vast majorities of voters support them. There's no way any Democratic politician should be shy about it.
Well, okay, fair enough, Michael. But how much did Walz lose by when he ran for re-election in Minnesota?
He didn't.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay.
He's successful, and he got his way onto the national ticket when the, you know, governor of New York is like speaking in the afternoon or the early evening outside of prime time, you know.
And that's well, and I think if you also look at the, you know, the results of Hochul's last reelection, where she barely beat out a Republican in New York State. So, you know, I just think it bears out in both directions.
So, Olivia, how do you think about this idea of, I'll just throw a phrase at you. Americans want more moderation. Americans are more centrist collectively. What do you think?
I think I talk to everyday New Yorkers every day of my life. I'm a community organizer, and I have been for the past 15 years. So I think what Americans want, and definitely what New Yorkers want, are people who take their problems seriously. I think there's a lot of rejection of rhetoric, and there's a lot of rejection of big ideological talk. But when you get down to the ideas, people want help getting to work. They want protections at work. They want help paying their rent. They want to be able to buy a house or be able to afford an apartment easily. They are sick of having to work two jobs, have both parents working to afford balancing our, you know, exorbitant rents and childcare. And they just want to see people who want to deliver results. I think if you look at the way that Hochul campaigned, she was taking a Republican narrative. She's not presenting a different vision for the state of New York, and people are sick of the same. They don't want to see Republican light. And if those are the two options, they're going to pick the real deal. They're not going to pick the diet version of the Republican agenda.
Well, what's an example, Olivia, when you think of Governor Hochul, in the words of the op-ed, engaging in policies or supporting policies that screw over workers. What's an example of that, Olivia?
I mean, I think, you know, her total reluctance to put together a really strong housing deal and fully support good cause eviction. You know, we know that every gain that workers have made in their contracts has been eaten up by rent increases. And we have to look at people's lives as a holistic environment. We can't just look at wages as one separate thing. When those wages don't go further, or don't go as far as they used to, then workers are losing power. So that's a clear and concrete example. Failing to cap rent increases and put a good cause package together until just this past year, failing to include upstate cities and townships in that package. So now we're seeing local municipalities passing good cause campaigns, good cause legislation left and right. And it's clearly popular legislation that is meaningful for people. And it's something that she could have done, 4 years ago, 2 years ago, and ran on it.
Michael, I want you to define a term for me as well. When you guys talk about corporate Democrats instead of maybe other kinds of Democrats, I'd like to hear your description of that, because I am thinking of the governor of New York State and asking myself, you know, like, what do people think that she, you know, is about? When people think about what drives Kathy Hochul, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe listeners will weigh in with that. In fact, I've got a couple of emails already. Connections at WXXI.org. Listeners, connections at WXXI.org. Or you can call the program toll free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I don't know what people necessarily, what comes to mind for people when they think, hey, Governor Kathy Hochul, she's a governor and she's all about X. I don't know. But for you, you've described her as a corporate Democrat. What is a corporate Democrat?
Well, I think, you know, Olivia and I have done a lot of work together over the years. And one of the things we've always done is followed the money. If you look at Kathy Hochul's main campaign contributions from early in her career to now, She's always been backed by the biggest billionaires and corporations, the Jacobs and Pakula families from Buffalo, now Wall Street billionaires, New York City real estate billionaires. She raised more money in 90 days from billionaires and the biggest corporations than Andrew Cuomo had managed to raise in 12 years. So she is joined at the hip with these corporations. And that's the kind of thing that leads to real results for the billionaire class and watered down, you know, half measures for the working class. Amazon is getting subsidized low-cost green energy for its warehouses when regular people are struggling to pay their utility bills, right? Amazon is getting hundreds of millions of dollars worth of subsidies without strong labor protections that require, you know, union organizing on the site, right? Every once in a while, we get a little something for the people that build the thing, but never for the people that operate it. The Buffalo Billion, you know, the stadium subsidies in New York City, again, we continually see meager budgets for regular working people. And at this point, I think we're over double digit billions a year in corporate giveaways. You know, that's over $10 billion a year in quote unquote economic development that allows her to do a ribbon cutting, but doesn't involve the long-term benefits that communities really need: jobs, schools, parks, great public infrastructure, the kinds of things that really build and grow communities. So we think you can do it a different way. We think you can build the economy from the middle out and the ground up. President Biden made some strong strides in that direction, pushed by Bernie, pushed by AOC. And, you know, there are Democrats across the state and across the country that are ready to unify and go in that direction if you have the leadership that will take them there. So our argument is that we'll have a more successful state, we'll have more successful communities, and regular working people, families will benefit if we go in the direction that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and Gretchen Whitmer and AOC and some of these other national level Democrats are trying to take us.
We're talking to Michael Kink, Executive Director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition, Olivia Lehrer, Co-Director of New York Communities for Change. And they are, you know, if not explicitly, they're at least challenging the idea that the Democratic Party is fully united coming out of last week by saying, united for what? What do you stand for? And, you know, where do you go now that you've got this moment of the nation's attention on you? The party, at least I think a lot of people in Chicago last week, wanted to feel unified. Question is, what do you stand for? And Charlie in Pittsford challenges me. Charlie says, Evan, of course Hochul spoke out of prime time for completely practical reasons. New York State is a lock for the Electoral College votes. The Democrats needed to get the bubble states in front of the national audience to fire up the electorate in those states. That and the fact that Hochul is not the most eloquent speaker. Charlie, that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair as far as it goes. And she's not, I mean, it's not a sin to not be a super dynamite public speaker. I get it. But she's just not really viewed as either a big political talent or kind of a big political thinker, not as far as I know. And I do think it's still a little bit remarkable that a governor of New York would be, you know, kind of just so outside of the discourse all week long about big issues when a lot of other governors, and you're right, some of those governors I'm talking about are swing states, but Maryland is not a swing state, and their governor is viewed as a possible future president, although he has been very defensive of the possible Harris administration's relationship with big business. I don't know how Michael and Olivia feel about that. J.B. Pritzker is the governor of Illinois, and he is a billionaire, a literal billionaire. He talked about that in his speech. So it was a panoply, Charlie, and governor of New York State was just a very, very small part of that tapestry, is kind of what I'm observing here. So let me ask Michael and Olivia another question. I want to push on some of what Michael said, get both of you on this. Yeah, you can be optimistic, certainly, about what you think a Harris administration would do. And I know that you are, and you both want to talk about the effect of labor and labor's presence last week. But before we do that, I think a lot of people are also looking at Kamala Harris and saying, Well, how do you know? Because 4 or 5 years ago, she was talking about being, you know, pro-banning fracking. Now she is not. She was, you know, in a little bit of a different place on criminal justice 4 or 5 years ago. And now she's really much more back in the mode she was in when she was working in California. And so, Michael, are you comfortable saying, I feel like I know what the administration would do?
Well, I think we have her track record as vice president, as a presidential candidate, her recent speech in North Carolina on economic policy and affordability was pretty specific on the points we're talking about, cracking down on corporate greed and price gouging, lowering drug prices, protecting Medicare, building more housing and ensuring affordable housing by cracking down on corporate landlords, you know, expanded real world benefits for working families, 25 grand for first time home buyers, a significantly expanded child tax credit with $6,000 in direct support the first year of a child's life. I mean, 25,000 is real. 6,000 is real. She has to lead the effort to pass that kind of legislation and those kinds of budgets in through the Congress. But I think we can get there, and I think she's taken some real stances. There has been some reporting on economic policy that she is, you know, fully in favor of blocking the, you know, giveaways to the rich that were in the Trump tax cuts / Trump tax scam and going higher on corporate profits and tax rates, all to fund the kinds of investments in communities that are broadly popular. I agree with you. You know, she's shading on fracking. She's not yet taken strong stances on criminal justice reform and decarceration. There's, you know, aspects of her record over time that have troubled some people and excited some people. But I think at this point, what she has potentially behind her is a movement. And when the movement includes community organizing groups like New York communities from all over the country, when it includes, you know, Bernie and AOC and Pramila Jayapal and Elizabeth Warren, as well as, you know, John Mannion and Kathy Hochul and J.B. Pritzker, when you're leading a movement, you're accountable to the people in the movement. And we're going to be fighting to make her the best possible president she can be.
Olivia, can you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's an old organizing adage, you're not choosing a champion, you're electing a target. So I think that's definitely how we see it when we look at the options. And you know, I think we should be clear, right? Governor Walz didn't just deliver these progressive victories to Minnesotans by himself, right? There was a movement in Minnesota that made that possible. I think what we're seeing right now, and to King's point, that there's a movement lining up behind her. There's a lot of people in this country who don't want to see a Trump presidency, but more than that, they want to see a future for Americans that actually works for working people. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of people lining up to hold her accountable. And that's, you know, that's our job as organizers, and it's what we need to continue to do. But I think if anybody thinks that any president is going to get elected and then deliver anything, even if they say every right thing to hear, no one can accomplish anything without a movement behind them and without organizing to push to make sure these things happen.
We're talking to Olivia Lehrer, co-director of New York Communities for Change, Michael Kink, executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. They're drawing distinctions that they see between New York Governor Kathy Hochul and at least the Harris-Walz ticket and what they think a Harris-Walz administration would do. Let's take our only break of the hour. If you're on the phone or if you've emailed, we'll get some of your comments on the other side of this, our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, it's part of our series of interviews with candidates for office, candidates who are likely to be on your ballot, and it's Monroe County Clerk Jamie Romeo, who is running for re-election. In our second hour, our annual Rochester Fringe Preview, we're looking at the dozens of shows, big and small. Talk with you Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Damila on the phone has been waiting. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Simple. Any governor who acknowledges and knows that there is severe housing shortage and give $650 million to a multi-billionaire for an NFL team has got to go.
You're talking about the Bills Stadium.
Yeah, she's got to go. There's no justification for it. I couldn't care less if the bills relocated to China when it comes to putting people first. She's got to go.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the phone call, Demelo. Thank you. I heard Michael, I think, laughing there. I don't think the Bills are going to relocate to China. They're going to get that stadium, and it's probably going to end up being more like $800 million in public money, if not more than that. But the governor says she's from Buffalo. It's part of the regional identity, and it's an economic driver. What do you think, Michael Kink?
Well, I didn't think Jerry Jones was going to let the Bills move to Austin, Texas, which was the like threat that wasn't real. I agree that the housing shortage in New York is insane and difficult. And, you know, if we had a governor that was really working for the people, again, she'd be working from the middle out, from the ground up, paying attention to the real needs of 19.5 million New Yorkers, as opposed to, 125 billionaires. We can do better. I don't know. You know, like the governor deserves a challenge when the times come. But I think right now, you know, we'd like to see more New York politicians follow the lead of other folks that aren't her from all over the country and out of the state than necessarily like take her all the way down this second. We have some elections to win. And at least we're unified around that.
Olivia Lear, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at even in her last, in just this past year's proposal, she's proposing developing housing on state-owned land without making any affordability requirements attached to it. So it's clear that the scale and scope of the housing crisis is not something that's on her mind.
Okay. I appreciate that, Demelo. Thank you. Angela writes to say, Evan, we are united after the convention. You can't stop us now, no matter how hard you try. Angela, I'm not trying one way or another to do anything. I'm just having a conversation. I hope that's clear. But Angela is saying we are united. So, Olivia, what does it mean to be a united Democratic Party?
I think in this moment, Democrats are united around the danger of a Trump presidency, around wanting a future that doesn't continue to go down the path of right-wing authoritarianism that, you know, that we've seen coming out of the Trump camp. And I think there's definitely unity around that. And I, you know, I hope that there's continued unity around a narrative and an agenda of economic prosperity that centers workers. And, you know, I think it's very hopeful. And I certainly hope we're united.
Michael Kink, what does Democratic unity actually mean to you?
You know, Governor Hochul has spoken very strongly, very personally, very favorably about building union power and about the role of unions, right? It's important to her personal story. My grandparents, you know, made progress in unionized steel mills the way her parents did. That's real, and that's a unifying point. I think we're unified on winning elections, defeating Trump, defeating the extremist agenda, Project 2025 from the Republican members of Congress that are trying to impose this draconian rule on the rest of the country. That's unified. But I do think there's a legitimate policy discussion within Democrats who agree on Democrats winning elections on what's the best way forward. Are you more likely to win if you're fighting for a higher minimum wage for working people, better investments in public schools, free college, and making the rich pay what they owe to pay for it? You know, we think those are positive policies that are really popular. They're both good policy and good politics. And I don't think we're fighting against other Democrats. We're trying to persuade Democrats that are trying to win elections that the way to win it is listening to Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and maybe not so much listening to Kathy Hochul.
Or Jonathan Chait, who wrote a piece last week saying Democrats must now tack to the center. So, again, we've talked about what the center even means. Douglas Jay, who writes the New York Times PitchBot account on Twitter, was on this program and said, what does it mean to be a centrist? You know, if one side says, let's nuke a million people, and you say, let's nuke nobody, does a centrist say, let's compromise, how about 500,000? I mean, that's silly, of course. But his point was, sometimes it is correct to take a viewpoint that is not necessarily perfectly moderated or sort of triangulated. And so, you know, there's a couple of points I want to hit here on union support. I don't know if the mention of of labor and unions did set a record. A lot of people are saying this is the most pro-union Democratic National Convention in decades. You saw Sean Fain speaking there. President Biden mentioned his joining a picket line. And in the clip that we played from Kamala Harris earlier this hour, one of the biggest roars in that sort of cascade of building roars when she's talking about the economy is when she talks about bringing labor to the table. So, you know, again, what does it mean in practice to change that? We don't see union membership. I think we see union membership, Michael and Olivia, something like at half the levels from 1980. So I don't know what it means in practice, but can you both weigh in? I'll start with you, Olivia. I mean, was this truly a pro-labor, pro-union convention? And then if so, what does that mean going forward?
I mean, I think, you know, we've seen real challenges to labor's ability to move power, to build power over over the past, you know, several years. We've seen increasing number of right to work legislation. We've seen Supreme Court rulings that make it harder for public sector unions to enroll members. So, you know, I think there have been real challenges to building worker power into the labor movement. And I think, you know, hearing on the Democratic National Convention stage, the, you know, the mention of organized labor, the mention of building worker power over and over and over again, to me definitely sends a sign that that, you know, that worker power is being centered. And I think it's, you know, it's pretty clear in Project 2025, it's pretty clear in, you know, in the Heritage Institute that there's a very anti-organized labor, you know, effort coming from the other side.
Okay. Michael Kink, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's real. And there are some national and state level issues at play here. You know, Sean Fain is a dynamic leader, Randy Weingarten from the AFT, Melinda Persson from NYSIT. These are, you know, transformative figures that are winning big, strong contracts for their members and trying to fight for more union membership all over the country. Sarah Nelson from the flight attendants. You know, the union movement, the labor movement is rich in leadership. And, you know, here in New York, Olivia and I worked on the Fight for 15, better pay in a union for fast food workers. You know, when the Fight for 15 kicked off, it was a transformative goal. $15 at that point would make a real difference in the lives of everyday working people. You know, now the equivalent would be $25 or $30. And Governor Hochul at the Capitol kind of shaved down our recent effort to win a minimum wage increase to, you know, 50 cents, 75 cents here and there, right? Those are the kinds of things where stronger leaders, stronger platforms, more of a buy-in from all Democrats is what's needed to really expand and grow the labor movement. Again, you know, there's a link to corporate subsidies. If you're giving away huge corporate subsidies without any strings attached, you're missing an opportunity to build a unionized workforce. And, you know, we should not just have construction workers that are in unions building the chip fab plants in the Amazon warehouse. We should be having union workers operating those warehouses and operating those chip fab facilities. Those are the kinds of things that will build a bigger, broader middle class here in New York and across the country.
But Michael, what is realistically, let's say Harris and Walz win, 4 years from now, they're running for re-election and union membership has done what? What is realistic as a goal?
I think we could see explosive gains. You know, we were having the, you know, the hot labor summer with the Amazon workers and the Starbucks workers and the UAW.
I miss hot labor summer. It's a hot everything summer. But yeah, hot labor summer. I'm not cool enough.
Olivia was right. You know, there are things we've seen both at state level and national level in terms of organizing policies. You know, the Trump administration, Project 2025, they want to make the entire country a right to work operation. They want to gut public and private sector union power. Trump like scabbed out and talked with Elon Musk about firing union workers at factories, right? There is a clear line here of one party, the Democrats on the side of the working class, and the Republican Party on the side of the billionaire class. And I think some of that goes back to your question about moderation and mainstream, right? The elites, I think the right wing works really hard to divide the working class. And when you look at actual things like labor power, we should have millions and millions more members in both public sector and private sector unions. We should be supporting broad organizing. The PRO Act that the AFL-CIO and others have been working for to strengthen the NLRB, to make unionization more straightforward and easier, to get rid of the tangles, to let workers control their own destiny and work with their friends and neighbors to have a better economic future. We need more of it. And it really should be millions, tens of millions more members. That's within our grasp. If we get a triple blue majority, of the type that might be possible in Congress, working people could make real progress in New York and across the country.
Well, it's like you're reading my email here, Michael King. So I'm going to read a bunch here, but let me just go to David's. David writes, Evan, give me a break. Donald Trump and Elon Musk were riffing on getting off on firing striking workers when they talked on Twitter or X or whatever you call it now. Governor Kathy Hochul might not be all that great, but she is in no way equal to them. That is from David. She is in no way equal to Trump and Musk, who were talking about, in his words, getting off on firing striking workers, Michael King. So how could you compare the two?
It really is crazy. And, this conversation that we've seen among the Jonathan Chaits of the world and the Fox News talk shows, they're trying to use cultural issues like, do you drive a pickup truck versus an electric vehicle? Those aren't like real things. Like, do you support the PRO Act? Do you support protecting the right to organize? Do you support building labor power? Do you get off it on firing, or screwing over working people, right? We have a new opportunity here. The FDR, built the labor power with the legislation that was passed in the New Deal. He didn't, he was rich, and he didn't, he certainly, talked to and worked with other of the banker billionaire class of his time. But he said, I welcome the hatred of the people that opposed him, right? And I think that kind of approach of acknowledging that there's going to be opponents, you don't just suck up to the billionaires like Kathy Hochul. Sometimes you have to fight like hell to win the gains. I think that's where Sean Fain and AOC and Kamala Harris and Tim Walz can stand together and really build some opportunity for working people.
All right, Olivia, what would you say to David, who says that Hochul is in no way the same as Musk and Trump with workers?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. And I think the point that Michael and I are trying to make is that when we see the Democratic leadership in a state like New York not standing up and putting forth the bold vision for working people that we could and should be, then it's actually paving the way for more Trump-like policies to win. So, if we look at the last gubernatorial election in New York in 2022, Hochul was running against Lee Zeldin, who was a MAGA figure coming out of Long Island, and barely won by, just maybe a dozen points.
I don't even know if it was five points. I mean, it was five points.
Yeah. And getting closer every day at the end,
Exactly. And I think this kind of middle of the road failing to invest in things that real people can see in their pockets. I think what happens in voters' minds is that if I've already elected a Democrat here, why bother? Right. If I have a Democrat as the mayor of the biggest city in the state, if I have a Democrat in the governor's office, if I have Democratic supermajority in the assembly and the legislature, and I'm still not seeing change and real things that impact me, then why bother? Why even show up to the polls? And so I think that's the fear that we're talking about, is what a demobilized base does to electoral outcomes, and not comparing Trump to Hochul. Of course, Hochul's agenda is a lot less scary, but when Democrats don't lead, it paves the way for this kind of authoritarian takeover.
We're seeing more mobilization. Seeing more people excited about the election. We're seeing more people willing to go knock on doors and organize their friends. The excitement is partially vibe. It's partially, the positivity, but it's also partially the substance. I mean, people won't take time out of their day without feeling like they're really going to go get something that is meaningful to them, their families, their communities. And that's the opportunity here. We think we'd win those elections, win more elections, and win by bigger margins if you're fighting for things that people can feel.
Tom writes to say, when I think of Kathy Hochul, I just think generic Democrat. That's from Tom. Kathy in Chilai says, hi, guys. I would submit that there is so much money influencing legislators via donors, lobbyists, and party members with conflicting views organizing primary challenges that it's not something that can be changed until money is out of politics. The Democrats can, on rare occasions, get some legislation passed, but it gets gutted over the ensuing years to the point that it doesn't make much difference in the lives of voters. So Democrats get a reputation for being ineffective. Affordable Care Act, a target for Republicans and insurance companies since it was passed, the Dodd-Frank bill trying to limit banks, recent SCOTUS decisions stripping power from federal agencies to enforce things like the Clean Water Act come to mind. Pretty much everything that makes it through to law these days is Republican light. That is from Kathy in Chilai. What do you think, Olivia?
I think that's exactly right. I think, I think that there's real issues when it comes to money in politics. I think that, you know, the power of the people is definitely diluted. But I also think that there's ultimately organized people can win out over organized money. It's something that we've seen in elections all around the state. We've seen real progressive elected officials with real economic policy platforms running and winning from the Hudson Valley to New York City to Albany. And, you know, we've seen real victories. And, you know, I think when we have organized people and real enthusiasm and momentum, it can win out over the money, but money in politics is certainly a challenge that we run up against over and over and over again.
Okay. Michael, anything to add there?
I mean, we're feeling Chilai. Like, it's time to end Republican light. Democrats should not be fighting for a 10th of a loaf, a 25th of a loaf. They should be fighting for things that people can see and feel. If Kamala Harris gives $25,000 to young families trying to buy their first home, people are going to remember that. $6,000 for a new family with their kid in the first year, people are going to remember that. College that's free, childcare that's free without long waiting lists, those are real meaningful things to bring affordability to people's lives. I mean, President Biden even came out for rent caps and some sort of good cause eviction program, right? He's coming out for taxing the investment gains of billionaires, right? Those are things that have broad popularity among all kinds of voters, whether they describe themselves as progressive and or liberal or moderate or conservative. So we don't have to accept Republican light. We really can do better. There is a majority of Americans that wants that, and we need politicians that will go fight for it.
All right, down to our last few minutes here. And you know, a number of other listeners have pointed out that, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom from California didn't get a primetime speaking slot, Evan. So it's not just Kathy Hochul. And, you know, sure, we can get down in the weeds if you want. My lay opinion with no insider information is that Gavin Newsom probably envisioned himself at the top of a ticket if Joe Biden stepped down this year. And he's not at the top of a ticket. I don't know. I'm just observing that. Well, you know, the lay of the land is that Governor Hochul is not kind of in the mix of big influence makers in the Democratic Party, and she's the governor of New York. So as we get ready to wrap here, I'll just ask our guests a minute apiece. What do you want to leave with listeners as you look ahead to the election, but beyond here? Olivia, what do you want people thinking about?
Yeah, I hope people will think about the kind of New York that they want to see and get involved in organizing to fight for it. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter who wins or loses. If there's not a movement behind them, then we're not going to see the kind of change that we need. And if we want big economic policy changes, if we want a bold agenda, then we need folks to organize. So I think, you know, find an organization. Mine is New York Communities for Change. We organize low and moderate income folks all over New York City and Long Island. There's lots of other groups out there that are organizing all across the state. And you know, I think we'd love to see you with us in the Capitol. We'd love to see you with us in our neighborhoods. And And we'd love to be in the fight with everybody who cares about the future of New York and making New York a place where everyday people have a future we can thrive in.
Michael Kink?
Yeah, I agree with Olivia. Organizing from the ground up with community organizations, with labor unions, you know, Citizen Action, the great area labor federations across the state. There's a lot of opportunities for people to jump in and work together with their friends and allies to elect Democrats and then hold them accountable to get the kind of policies we need. And I think what we've seen in the convention, what we've seen from Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, what we're seeing in some of these U.S. House campaigns across New York and across the country is a new way forward. We don't have to accept more of the same. We can have change. We can get bigger wins that regular people and families can feel. And that can lead to a more prosperous country with an economy that works for everyone, not just the billionaire class. It's possible to do it. We just need the leadership and the people power that'll fight to make it happen.
I want to thank our guests for making time. And, you know, it's an interesting set of ideas coming out of a convention where, yes, as Angela emailed me earlier, Democrats often say they're feeling united. But our guests are challenging the party to really analyze what it stands for and what it's going to accomplish if it wins. Michael Kink, Executive Director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it.
Olivia Lear, Co-Director of New York Communities for Change. Thank you, Olivia.
Thank you so much for having me.
From the whole team at Connections, it's Evan and Megan and Julie, the music from Barsook Records, and the whole team at WXXI. We thank you for listening, and we'll be back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.